Bleiben wir hier.
Hello and welcome to our podcast, The Past is a Foreign Country. My name is Roham and I am part of a small group of five bachelor and master students in cultural anthropology at the Johannes Gutenberg University Mainz. I will be your host and speak in this podcast with two of my fellow students, Sophia and Jerain.
Hello, I'm Sophia.
And I'm Jerain, hello.
In the summer semester of 2024, our group explored the topic of memory, history, and the archive as part of historical anthropology through the example of the German Democratic Republic, or in short, GDR. We focused on Berlin as the former world-renowned symbol of the Cold War and went on a short field trip to the German capital in May. As cultural anthropologists, we have been particularly interested in the challenges that representation of and research into the past can bring. We explored different modes of learning about East Germany's past. In Berlin, we went on a guided walking tour, visited both the Stasi Museum and the GDR Museum, spoke to a contemporary witness, and explored sample files in the Stasi Records Archive. In this podcast, we want to share with you our experiences, thoughts, and reflections on the challenges of representing and researching the GDR past.
Yes, but let's start at the beginning, shall we? What did we actually know about the former East Germany prior to the semester start?
Good point. I think most of us imagine a wall to keep citizens in the country, bugged apartments, Stasi spies on every street corner. Also food shortage and years of wistful waiting for cars and washing machines. At least that was pretty much the picture of the DDR we had at the beginning of the semester. An image that was shaped by popular movies like Goodbye Lenin and The Lives of Others and TV series like Deutschland 83, Cleo or Weißensee that many of us had watched. But I guess there were also many half-truths and stereotypes. I never really thought about what life was like for East Germans who actually had lived in this country.
Yeah, for me, being born and raised in Iran, I was always told by my parents that communism is an ideology that will eventually lead to nothing but a lack of wealth and a dictatorship. My parents believed that people in the GDR were extremely poor and lived in horrible conditions, under a totalitarian regime that forced them to always wear a uniform. After moving to Koblenz in Germany, I heard only about the negative aspects of life in the GDR. For example, how East Germans had to sign up for a car called Trabi and wait for years, decades even, to get that car. And of course, that they were stuck behind a huge cement wall that separated the two German countries.
Well, I actually did not know very much about the GDR either. Just some basic facts about the planned economy, politics, and some key dates like 1961 and 1989. Because I'm from Russia and have learned about the Soviet Union from my family and in school, I had some clue about socialist life during the Cold War. I guess I made conjectures based on my Soviet Union knowledge what life must have been like in the GDR as a satellite state of the Soviet Union. As anthropologists, we are interested in what people do and think, but I didn't know what moved people in the GDR, what did they dislike, what did they enjoy in their daily lives. Like you guys, I did not really know anything about popular culture, leisure activities, or the workplace in the GDR. I guess we all had a rather black and white picture of this foreign country, and we hoped to fill it with some color during our trip to Berlin.
Totally. Maybe that's my cue to start with Whitlam Berlin tours. Our first memory intermediary, or what you could call people and institutions engaged in conveying memory in different ways and for various purposes to other people. Johnny Whitlam is a Berlin tour guide, originally from Great Britain. Having gained more than 12 years of tour guiding experience in 2022, he took the plunge and started his own business. He offers a wide range of tours, from the history of the Weimar Republic and the Nazi period to fascinating insights to Berlin, from its Jewish culture to football and even techno clubs. As a business owner, Johnny relies not only on word of mouth, but also promotes his tours on social media. On Instagram, his 41.4 thousand followers can listen to his engaging fun facts and historical anecdotes about Berlin. We were keen to find out more about his stories of Berlin as a divided city and capital of the former socialist East Germany. After our arrival in Berlin, we went straight on his Cold War walking tour.
It was so good to stretch our legs and go for a walk after that long train journey.
Sure thing. But I found the walking tour also overwhelming. Johnny told us about historical events in such an engaging way that many of them stuck with me. You could tell that conveying Berlin's history to others was not just a job for him, but his passion. I just had to pay attention to his informative yet humorous and charismatic way of talking about these events. I particularly remember the story about the man fleeing the border by hiding behind an American military bus at Checkpoint Charlie. I found it amusing, and to be frank, also a bit unbelievable. But, and here comes the big but, since his tour was covering the entire history of Berlin, from the early stages of the 12th century to the unification in 1990, we spent less time than I expected on the GDR period. I wanted to hear more about life under the socialist regime. Sure, visiting Checkpoint Charlie, Brandenburg Gate, and walking across places where once a wall with a death strip made this impossible, while listening to Johnny's stories, is much more immersive experience than reading a book about it. But some of it got lost as we were bombarded with information from the early stages of Berlin up until that point that interested us.
True that, but I also wondered with what past, when exactly, to start if you wanted to understand the GDR past. It's not that there was nothing before, and the GDR would have never come into existence without Germany's Nazi era.
Sure, and all in all, I have to say, learning about the entire history of Berlin was remarkable, and for that I feel privileged. If I were a tourist visiting Berlin, this tour would have been perfect and perhaps exceeded my expectations. But since I was there to learn more about the GDR and life in East Germany, it left me somewhat confused for its lack of focus.
I know what you mean, and I guess we had this much-needed focus when we visited the Stasi Museum on the second day.
Exactly. Located on the grounds of former headquarters of the Ministry for State Security, or MFS for short, the Stasi Museum educates its visitors on the surveillance strategies of the East German Secret Police, or Stasi. The museum was founded in November 1990 by the Anti-Stalinistische Aktion, or ASTAG. This association was launched by East German civil rights activists who had occupied the Stasi headquarters in January 1990. To ensure its independence, ASTAG finances its work through admission fees and donations. Since 2015, the museum showcases the permanent exhibition State Security and SED Dictatorship that we visited.
Because the museum is basically a historical site where the Stasi used to work, we walked through the rooms of the former head of the MFS, Erich Mikl. I felt all the furnishings were rather drab by today's standards. The tour guide also pointed out a few times that Mikl, who not only had his office, but also sleeping quarters there, insisted on basic stuff like a black and white TV, even though he could have had the latest color TV from the West. This seemed odd to me, given his power. I learned a lot about the different technologies the Stasi used to spy on people, even though these cameras hidden in hotel walls or in gardening cans may feel a little old-fashioned to us now, They were top-notch at the time and gave a good sense of the secrecy aspect of their work. And although the Stasi Museum focused on the Stasi as this repressive state tool to ensure the party's power, it aims to convey that there were many other effective control mechanisms within society. One thing that really struck me was the socialist military education that started early on for children who were taught that this was about protecting peace. Especially the mock hand grenade that was on display that school children had to throw as an exercise shocked me, but not you two.
Yeah, military exercises are a pretty standard part of school education in Russia.
And Iran.
New to me was also the role of the churches as a safe haven for many people in the DDR. I mean, I knew that state and church stood in opposition, but I didn't realize that East Germans who either had applied to immigrate to West Germany or were somehow different from the norm sought refuge in the church.
Yes, I was surprised the churches existed at all. Even though they were under surveillance, I thought there would be much more repression of religion as was the case in the Soviet Union.
I also could connect these dots between church and state better from the conversation we had with the contemporary witness after a guided museum tour. Let's listen to Fabian and Roham's first impression that they recorded straight after their talk.
Yeah, of course, it was really impressive to talk to the woman we just sat together with, because I think it gives history a completely different dimension. If you have people around you who witnessed what happened in the GDR, and she told us that she wanted to leave the country in 1984. Which she wasn't allowed to, and after that the Stasi began to investigate in her life, and she was had a lot of problems because of it.
I saw the similarities in him and I could relate to it, but that's what talking to contemporary witnesses is all about. It's about to being able to relate to these people, how real and how, well, terrifying reality could be at times, and that is the beauty of having a witness that you could talk to from that time.
I'm cringing a bit to listen to myself speak.
Wait till you listen to this whole podcast.
I think for me, the witness account was somehow more real, authentic, if you like, because we just had a conversation with another human being. She told us about her experience with the Stasi, but also what life was like in general in the GDR. If I was to compare it with our interactions with Johnny, our tour guide, this conversation was very different. It wasn't totally dark, but it wasn't as lighthearted either. It felt not just like the tip of the iceberg as during the walking tour, but somehow more profound to hear her own GDR life experiences.
Sure, but even though she encouraged us to ask questions, you could tell she had done such talks before. I sensed that she had her own set narrative. And she didn't just tell us about her own experience, she also told us about other people's. Like that woman that the Stasi drove almost into a nervous breakdown because they secretly entered her flat and changed the towels in her bathroom. And remember, the following day, at the Stasi Records Archive, our guide told us almost the exact story. It made me wonder whether hearing this story twice made me feel it must be true and remember it, compared to other stories I had only heard once and perhaps for good. Or whether hearing the same story retold by two different people that had actually not experienced or witnessed it made it feel less genuine. I don't know the answer to it.
Oh wow, I didn't notice, but there was so much to take in. Actually, let's talk about the Stasi Records Archive. Like the Stasi Museum, it is located on the historical site of the former MFS headquarters. Belonging since 2021 to the Federal Archive, it originally was the responsibility of the Federal Commissioner for the Records of the Stasi, or BSTU, founded in 1991 to preserve the legacy of the MFS. In 1990, civil rights activists seized these files before the MFS could destroy them completely. There are a total of 111 kilometers of files that are not only in Berlin, but also spread across the 12 regional offices in the former county or Bezirk capitals of East Germany. What is important to know is that there is a special law, the 1991 Stasi Records Act, that instead of sealing these records for 30 years, allowed people to access their own file immediately. A person must apply to the Stasi Records Archive that will then investigate whether they have such a file, all of which is free of charge. In other words, as the German state's mission is to work through the GDR past, the archive is state-funded to enable its support for research, education, and media engagement with the Stasi legacy.
I think because we had already learned more about the state security and the Stasi Museum, we were all rather keen to dig deeper and to explore the Stasi record archive. We had lots of questions. How is the archive organized? What does a Stasi file look like? And how would it make us feel to read such a file?
We started in the morning with a guided tour through the exhibition, Einblick ins Geheime, or Access to Secrecy. It felt quite special as, unlike in the Stasi Museum, there were no other people around, which meant we could really focus on what our tour guide, an employee of the Stasi Records Archive, explained to us. We learned that index cards were the essential work tool for recording, storing, and evaluating information. There are 41 million index cards in total, which are separated into around 5,700 file card indexes. The headquarters archive is storing 18 million of them. These index cards are still crucial today as they are needed to find any Stasi files. For example, when people apply to access their file, an archive caseworker would check the index cards first.
The exhibition was great, but the building was a maze. The whole building complex is massive, but the building that housed the archive had also a different structure than the other buildings. To not be able to tell from the outside that it was an archive, the MFS had encased it by an administrative building. I somehow got lost which floor we were on, and because it is a listed building, it was also pretty warm and stuffy.
Yeah. Until we had a look at one of the actual archive rooms, which was pleasantly cool to preserve the files. And the files are today also in new storage boxes that are resistant to heat, moisture, and animal infestation. But what really blew my mind was looking at these massive shelves full of files. Even though we knew that the archive contained a total of 111 kilometers of files, I couldn't imagine how many files there would be. The one we looked at contained about 8 kilometers of files. I wasn't the only one that was stunned.
We all were. Storing these files and enabling access is of course very important for people that were harmed by the Stasi, or for those who want more clarity whether some aspects of their life had been shaped by the Stasi. But they are also great for researching this past and educating, especially younger generations, about a GDR dictatorship. But I think it's fair to say that the highlight for all of us was the afternoon session when we got the chance to look at some Stasi sample files.
Totally. When you hear or read about Stasi files in the media, it's so generalized. I never realized how many different types of files there were or how they were structured. For example, I looked at a sample file of an employee of the Stasi where I could read about how he was assessed by his handler, which was at times brutally honest, but it also included his own surveillance reports. This file is a very different type of file to an OPK file. OPK stands for Operative Personenkontrolle, or Operational Identity Check. For example, if a person was suspected of a crime, an OPK was carried out so that the Stasi could detect what they called hostile negative actions in time. Julia looked at an OPK file, a case that we had already discussed during the tour through the exhibition.
It was actually not that easy to make complete sense of these files, because they were obviously written from the perspective of the Stasi aims. Some personal details were also detracted in line with the Stasi Record Act to protect individuals' privacy. There were also many abbreviations that we didn't know and would need to look up. In general, the language was not only from a different time, but also a kind of Stasi speak. And there were the handwritten reports from unofficial collaborators. These were not always easy to decipher. All in all, I imagine doing proper research there requires an understanding of the Stasi structure and work. It takes quite some time and some serious detective skills.
Also because, as the archive employee pointed out, the sample files we had were exemplary, and the Stasi files rarely were that nicely ordered or complete.
Yes, working with these files was fascinating, and it was interesting how much the Stasi relied on these unofficial collaborators. I think today intelligence is gathered much more through various technologies. Oh, maybe we should talk about how astonished we were at the links between the Stasi and our region, the Rheinland-Pfalz.
Right. For me, it was actually hard to imagine that the Stasi would be helpful to anyone beyond the East German state. But the Operation Schwarzer Panther proved me otherwise. In November of 1970, David Jenkins, a former U.S.-American soldier, was injured in a crossfire with a security guard at the Ramstein military base. Now, for context, Jenkins was a member of the Black Panther Party, a Marxist, Leninist, and Black Power organization active in the USA from 1966 to 1982. After shots were fired, the Panthers fled, and Jenkins, hidden in the car trunk of two Western Germans, managed to escape. 2 days later, at Marienborn, a border crossing into East Germany, the Stasi discovered Jenkins and interrogated him and his West German helpers. The Stasi did not only attend to Jenkins' wounds, but also helped him flee to Algeria. They provided Jenkins with a fake passport and a fake visa. For me, this was one of the most fascinating things I've read in a while, because I would have never guessed that there could be any link between the Black Panther Party and the East German secret police, let alone any cooperation. It also linked in an unexpected way the GDR past with two subjects that I study, American studies and cultural anthropology.
Definitely. But what happened to Jenkins in Algeria?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know. This incident from 1970 uncovered in the Stasi files has left me with many questions. Why would the Stasi be motivated to help an American Black Panther member? In what way did it benefit them? Did it benefit them at all? Did the Black Panther Party in the US know about this? And also, what happened to Jenkins in Algeria? To some of these questions, I can make educated guesses. Given that the GDR viewed the USA as the imperialist enemy and that the GDR supported people and organizations abroad based on their shared ideology and practice of an international class struggle. But this story also made me realize that not all our questions can be answered with the Stasi files. These files represent a snippet or aspect of a larger story that happened in the past. But we only have access to that written down aspect in the present, and only from the perspective of the Stasi.
Totally. I felt in a similar way as you. First of all, I was surprised because somehow I thought of the Stasi as operating largely in the GDR and perhaps in West Berlin, but I never thought they would also be active in our region, the Rheinland-Pfalz.
Oh, tell that other story about Lutz Eigendorf from East Berlin that might interest our listeners that are also football fans.
Right. In 1979, the East Berlin footballer Lutz Eigendorf fled during a friendly match between his club BFC Dynamo and his opponent Erster FC Kaiserslautern. Eigendorf's escape to West Germany was perceived by the Stasi as a betrayal. It's also important to know that Stasi Minister Erich Mikl was the honorary chairman of the BFC football club, so he took Eigendorf's betrayal personal. Branded a traitor in the DDR, the Stasi began to monitor Eigendorf in the Rheinland-Pfalz. A West German retiree was employed as unofficial collaborator, or EM, and tasked to gather information not only on his target, Eigendorf, but also on the Erste FC Kaiserslautern, where he now played. In 1982, Lutz Eigendorf moved to Braunschweig, and the Stasi was no longer interested in the Pfälzer football club. Less than a year later, Eigendorf died, heavily intoxicated in a car accident. Apparently, even today, there are rumors about the Stasi having been involved in the footballer's untimely death. I found it fascinating how the past is never just over, but matters to people still today. But it's also quite frustrating that certainty about what happened in the past is actually much more difficult to obtain, if at all, than what I had previously imagined.
Yes, these case studies and reading through some files were super interesting, but they also made me realize that these files were not only written from the perspective of the Stasi, but are always just partial stories. And in a way, our picture of the GDR past can also never be truly nuanced if we look at the GDR state apparatus or even only at the Stasi. That's one reason why on the last day we visited the GDR Museum, which is in the heart of Berlin at the river Spree, not far from Museum Island. When the Freiburg ethnologist Peter Kenzelmann visited Berlin in the early 2000s, he was surprised that there was no museum that dealt with the GDR as a whole, not just its repressive state apparatus. Kenzelmann wanted to change this situation, and so in 2006, he founded the GDR Museum, which since then is run by a private initiative and supported by private donors. Today, the museum attracts its visitors with a promise to be one of the most interactive places in the world. A promise that the museum, under the scientific management of historian Dr. Stefan Wolle, is trying to fulfill with its 8,000 objects on display. These include a GDR prefabricated apartment, or Plattenbauwohnung, for visitors to walk through, or an original Trabant P601 car that can be taken on a simulated drive. In advance to our trip to Berlin, all these descriptions raise the question, is the GDR Museum really as lively, interactive, and yet scientifically sound as described on its homepage?
The GDR Museum is certainly the biggest and most famous of its kind that is dealing with GDR everyday life. It represents and shapes today's view on the former socialist state. So, what kind of picture of everyday life does the museum paint for its visitors?
Compared to other places we visited, the GDR Museum gave, in my opinion, a fuller picture of the former socialist state. It provided information about different aspects of everyday life, such as living arrangements, garden dachas, or how people spent their vacation, but also discussed important political dimensions of the GDR state.
I agree, but remember, when we left the GDR Museum, like any other visitors or the museum's shop, Fabian bought an eraser that looked like Karl Marx's head, and I thought that in our own heads remained many questions. Had this really been one of the most interactive museums in the world, or just one of the most crowded?
Yeah, we all felt relieved to escape the stuffy air and the crowds of people. When you try to pull open the countless drawers in the museum, you always had to be careful not to hit other visitors on the head or back. But that was not the only difference to other places we had visited in Berlin. Everything was busier, overcrowded, and in fact, more interactive. You could tell that the GDR Museum was designed for families to engage rather than explain history in a complex and extensive way. In my opinion, the museum's strength lie in showing rather than explaining. The exhibition covered topics like the Stasi, party organization, and politics, but its focus was really on everyday life. One could see a lot of pictures and furniture and read accompanying texts with detailed descriptions of how GDR citizens lived. The Plattenbauwohnung, or prefabricated apartment, which was furnished true to the original, the reproduced prison cell of Hohenschönhausen, the children's books in the cupboards, and the tin food in the kitchen drawers. It all gave us the sense of experiencing history firsthand, despite the sticky air and the crowds of people.
I agree. And that in the GDR Museum things are presented in a more simplified way is to be expected in an exhibition that tries to cover the entire history and culture of one country in a family-friendly way. But some of these simplifications can be also misread or seem to portray people as purely victims of an oppressive state. Although the GDR Museum represented everyday life, I felt it kept the clear binaries of a totalitarian perspective. Almost in every text, one could read about the oppressive state and oppressed people. For me, it was especially noticeable in the description of the Palace of the Republic, which housed, besides the People's Chamber, the GDR Parliament, also a House of Culture. Houses of Culture were clubhouses in Eastern Bloc countries where people could come together and do different types of activities, from eating together, watching films or theater performances, or doing sports. People who visited the Palace of the Republic to engage in their hobbies or meet their friends were described as agreeable to play the role of puppets in this spectacle. I find it hard to imagine that people would consider themselves as puppets. This statement reduced their personal engagement and interests, like hanging out with friends, for example, to one in which they are only and obediently play the roles that the state had intended for them. From an anthropological perspective, such descriptions are problematic, because they deny people in the GDR the ability to have led happy lives or portray them like they didn't have their own will to visit the House of Culture. But still, the exhibition was impressive. It flooded me with a huge amount of information, so maybe one visit is not enough to take it all in.
Yes, we felt all a bit overwhelmed when we left the museum. The museum's shop reinforced this feeling even more. After the socialist ideals shone aside, capitalist consumption reigned here. And this observation is perhaps more than just an ironic side note.
Absolutely. For me, it was interesting to see that the shop offered all these items with communist symbolism, like t-shirts with Karl Marx or Hero of Labor badges for people to buy. Of course, this generates income for the museum, but I wondered what it meant for customers. Why did they buy these items? Just for fun, as a souvenir? Or was this all just irony or even nostalgia for a time and a country they didn't experience themselves? There were no explanations of the meaning of the symbols during socialist times, so this wasn't exactly educative. Such items must feel different to former GDR citizens who once had lived with them and attached a particular meaning to them compared to a tourist from abroad.
The commercialization of the GDR past was very noticeable, not just in the GDR museum shop, but everywhere in Berlin where souvenirs were sold. Remember that shop dedicated to Ampelmännchen, the GDR-specific traffic lights we passed by a couple of days before the GDR Museum?
Oh, yes.
I still think that the GDR Museum fulfilled its goal to be an interactive family museum, where neither kids nor adults are bored. It represents many parts of the GDR and gives a much fuller image of how people lived there. The exhibition is nevertheless influenced by a totalitarian perspective in that it often portrays people as helpless victims instead of actors.
Yes, this was quite surprising. I mean, the Stasi Museum and the Stasi Records Archive zoom in on the DDR's secret police as the worst aspect of its repressive state apparatus. And after engaging with the Stasi for 2 days, one could get the impression that this was all what life in the DDR was about. At the same time, concrete case studies made history come alive. And there were frequent explanations from our tour guides and the contemporary witness that people cannot be easily categorized into perpetrators and victims, especially in cases of Stasi collaboration. I felt these were effective attempts to avoid such a black and white images that are still so prevalent in discussions of the former Eastern Bloc.
Perhaps on that note, I'll try to wrap up our reflections on how the GDR past was represented in Berlin and what avenues there are to research this past. It's fair to say that once back in Mainz, it was rather challenging for us to sort out all our impressions. The past and its commodifications were omnipresent in Berlin, and the GDR past plays a not insignificant part and why Berlin attracts so many tourists. But whether guided tours or museums, they are never just about turning entertainment into money, but they are always also communicating and shaping our collective memory. And while, of course, the Stasi Records Archive focuses on a particular aspect of the GDR past, the legacy of East Germany's secret police, it is not a tourist attraction. Its purpose is predominantly geared towards education and research. One key point to take away from this semester and this field trip is that we became aware of how the past changes in the present. Today's more nuanced discourses and representations of the GDR differ from those of the 1990s and 2000s we read about in the GDR seminar. Perhaps the most interesting aspect of our field trip were those stories that challenged our own perceptions or misconceptions of the former East Germany. To reduce people's lives to just one aspect, whether it be the Stasi or the Trabi, does injustice to East Germans' life stories that are just as complex as people's life stories elsewhere. As anthropologists, we need to listen to them just as much as we critically engage with museums' displays and other representations of the past. 4 days in Berlin were certainly not enough to grasp all the facets of representing and researching this past today. But it was a good start. We hope you enjoyed our first venture into producing a podcast, which undoubtedly was another challenge. Be sure to check out our university's other podcasts. Have a nice day, and auf Wiederhören.